This is Talk is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Please support independent radio. All right, today, Tom Hartman, part one on how the Democrats embraced corporations for funding. This is Tom Hartman, part one on the oligarchy and how the Democrats were the party of the working class, sort of, and then through lack of funding, embraced corporatism and funding from corporations. And hopefully now they're trying to go back with people voting, going to back to the supporters of the working class and environmentalism. All right, so that's part one. It's part two next week. I'll have a little bit more commentary for you next week. So here you go, Tom Hartman on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Support independent radio. There's a scourge threatening the airwaves right now. I'm talking about that earworm wrangler and rhyme criminal, Justin Bieber. I don't care if he gets his coke from Colombia, his product from Pennsylvania. He should be arrested just for rhyming holy with hold me. His music is vapid. His lyrics are trite. Now don't kill Justin Bieber. Cutting his hair will only slow him down. If you want to stop Justin Bieber and others like him, go to kepw.org and become a sustaining member, or just send a couple of dollars. We're all volunteers, so you get more bang for your buck. Go to kepw.org and stop inane music today.
Tom is the New York Times bestselling, four-time Project Censored award-winning author of, I think it's 25 books, but I hope I'll be forgiven if I'm off by a couple. His book, Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception, published back in 1993, sparked a national debate on ADD, ADHD, and neurological difference. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, was published in 1998 and inspired Leonardo DiCaprio's film, The 11th Hour. In 2010, Tom published Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, a book that so inspired Bernie Sanders that he read from it extensively on the floor of the Senate. Tom now has a hidden history series. It includes 11 paramount and timely books breaking down the obstacles obstacles facing today's society, placing them both in historical context and providing real, tangible calls to action for individuals and society at large. Recent entries in the series include 2018's The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, 2019's The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, and 2020's The Hidden History of Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream, which was the occasion of his last visit to Town Hall, virtually at least, about 6 months ago. The latest entry in the series is The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Working Class, and it's the subject of tonight's talk. Please join me in welcoming back Tom Hartman.
Thank you, Ware. It's an honor and a pleasure to be back with Town Hall Seattle. It's such a great venue, and I'm so pleased to be here. And thank you for the great introduction and your kind words. Thanks to Shane and Josh and the folks at Elliott Bay Books who are also on this, and everybody at Town Hall Seattle who are working to make this happen. Oligarchy, the reason why I started writing this book, which, you know, I began writing it about a year and a half ago, and it was that I've been watching this trend through the last 30 to 40 years of my life, and with growing alarm. And the Trump presidency just really brought it into sharp relief, and I felt like, you know, somebody needs to lay out how we got here, what the probable outcomes are, what the dangers are, and what we can do about it. And, you know, so thus the hidden history of American oligarchy. First, some definitions. Oligarchy, you know, the last time I was here, we were talking about monopoly. Monopoly is when a small number of actors, corporations typically, end up dominating a marketplace and thus pushing out competition. Oligarchy is like the political equivalent of that. It's where a small number of actors, typically very wealthy individuals, because wealth can translate into political power quite easily. It's a very fluid relationship. a small number of very powerful political actors seize control of the political marketplace, as it were, and turn it to their own benefit, and very often as a consequence of that, to the detriment of everyone else. A literal definition, well, maybe not literal, but you know, another way of defining oligarchy would be to say that it's when government ceases to work for the people and exclusively works for the very, very wealthy, or for the oligarchs who basically own and control the political space. And that's where we're at right now. And there's a reason why this is so dangerous. Oligarchies are inherently unstable, and I'll explain that in just a second. And they tend to flip in one of two directions, and we'll get to that also. But how do we know that we're in an oligarchy right now? Probably the best analysis that's been done was by two researchers, Benjamin Page and Matthew Gillens. They published their work back in 2014. I believe that they were with Princeton and Northwestern universities, as I recall. It's all in the book. And they were looking at, and by the way, they're not unique in having done this. There have been a number of subsequent studies, and there were a few smaller ones that weren't as well circulated prior to their work. So, you know, we can look at this more generally than just through the lens of this one study. But basically what they were looking at was, what's the relationship between what the majority of people want and what gets turned into legislation, into law, or public policy? Because that's the definition of democracy, demos, the people, right? What the people want is what the people get. And when they looked at the period before the Reagan Revolution, prior to 1980, what they found was that what the majority of people wanted frequently got translated into policy, very frequently. There was a clear correlation between public opinion polling that showed strong public support for particular issues, and those issues, and that, you know, those issues being converted into law. And that's how we got Medicare and Medicaid and the minimum wage. Well, that was in the 30s. Long-term unemployment payments, food stamps, housing support, a whole variety of Pell Grant type college supports, how we got brand new schools all across the United States, brand new hospitals built all across the United States, the Eisenhower Highway System of connecting the United States, new airports. I mean, you could probably complete the list or add to the list as well as I could. There are literally hundreds of programs that you can date back to the 1950s, 60s, and 70s in particular, many of them to the 1930s and 40s as well, that because of popular demand got turned into policy. After the Reagan Revolution, they looked at the same relationship between what the majority of people wanted and what actually happened. And what they found was that that correlation was completely broken. By 2000, the relationship between what people wanted in public opinion polls, and in some cases strongly wanted, and what we got was, to quote their study, you know, the statistical equivalent of random noise, of white noise. But what the top 1% wanted consistently got translated into public policy. You know, for example, the one major, really the only significant legislative accomplishment of the last 4 years of the Trump administration was a $2 trillion tax cut that principally benefited billionaires and big corporations. So what comes out of oligarchy in a situation like this, and this, I believe, is why we had Donald Trump as president, among other, along with all these other faux populists, you know, like Ted Cruz talking about, we love the working man, and that kind of stuff, is that the people start looking around going, you know, hey, you know, I don't think that, you know, we'd like to have a national healthcare system like every other developed country in the world does. You know, get with the program. You know, why do we have to have student debt in the United States? Literally no other developed country in the world has student debt. In Denmark, they pay you $400 a month to go to college. You know, and it's free. Why can't we have nice stuff, basically? Or, you know, why, and you know, seniors, you know, why are they constantly, you know, why does the Social Security increase go so slowly that seniors are sliding into poverty? Why is 20% of Medicare have to come from private companies? Why is it that in 2005, George Bush rolled out this new scam program called Medicare Advantage that now is doing serious damage to Medicare itself and is endangering the seniors who've signed up for it? Because it's just private insurance and they can kick you off and they can deny coverage, and they routinely do. You don't have the protections that you have with Medicare. Why is that? Why is that happening? And so somebody comes along like Donald Trump, who frankly stole parts of Bernie's platform. Donald Trump, you'll recall, campaigned on, I'm gonna raise taxes on billionaires. Remember he said, these my friends are gonna hate me. I'm gonna get killed with this tax increase I'm gonna get. He said, we're gonna give everybody in the country medical care, and it's gonna cost a hell of a lot less than Obamacare. Remember that? We're gonna bring back the jobs. We're gonna reverse the NAFTA and GATT and WTO free trade policies that were negotiated by the Reagan administration, turned into treaties by the first Bush administration and signed into law by the Clinton administration. We're gonna reverse all that stuff. And the 65,000 factories that have gone overseas in the last 20, 30 years, they're all gonna come back home. That's what he sold people. And because people knew that government wasn't working for them, when somebody comes along and says, you know, the game is rigged, it's a pretty seductive call. So that's another indicator that we're in an oligarchy. Oligarchies are very vulnerable to BS populism, to fraudulent populism. Bernie Sanders' populism was a genuine populism, the kind that Franklin Roosevelt rode to victory, because he actually did what he said he was gonna do, and it was actually what people wanted. Donald Trump's obviously was a phony populism, as is that of his wannabe successors, people like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton, etc. The reason why oligarchy is so dangerous is because as the people are increasingly cranked up over the fact that they know they're not getting what they want out of government, and they're protesting and they're writing letters to the editor and they're calling the members of Congress and they're showing up at the occasional town hall meeting and demanding things, and just nothing is happening. The nature of the government typically flips in one of two directions. Either the government fights back the oligarchy, which has happened twice in the history of the United States. I'll get to that in just a second. Or the government, the oligarchs, get together and say, we're not going to let go of this. We're going to hang on to this oligarchy. We're going to continue converting the wealth of this country into our own wealth. And these people who are protesting out here, we're going to create a police state to control them. And that's what you're seeing right now in Belarus, in Russia, in Hungary, in Poland. It's happening in Brazil. It's happening in the Philippines under Duterte. We're seeing countries that were democracies, even if only for a relatively short period of time, some of them long-term democracies, that have become oligarchies. And then when the oligarchy was challenged, instead of flipping back to being a democracy, they instead flipped into becoming police states. And we almost did that here in the last 60 days. That would have been, there's no doubt in my mind that had Donald Trump succeeded in overthrowing the election and was today the president, that within a year, a lot of people like me would be in jail, because that's typically the first thing that oligarchies do when they become police states. They start imprisoning journalists, and you'll recall, Donald Trump waged a war on the press for 4 years. They started imprisoning journalists and opinion writers. They imprison opposition politicians. Look at Navalny in Russia right now. I mean, this is just how they do it. They brutally crack down on people. So that's why the stakes are so high right now, and why I thought it was so important to have this book, to write this book. And I'm so glad that the book is out right now, because we're literally on a knife's edge. If Joe Biden and the Democrats cannot successfully demonstrate to the people of the United States that they can make government work for the people again, like it did prior to 1980, prior to the Reagan Revolution. If they cannot demonstrate that, then we're going to see this whole situation get much, much worse, which is why I've been begging people to call Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and any of the other Democratic senators who want to keep the filibuster so that Mitch McConnell can destroy any kind of legislation that the Democrats propose. If, on the other hand, you know, through good luck, good fortune, or a miracle, President Biden and the House and Senate can actually pass legislation that's more than just a, you know, here's $1,400, now shut up and go away, but instead real systemic change. If we can wipe out student debt, if we can produce a national health care system, these are things that have like 70, 80, 90% popularity among the people. Stop banks from ripping people off. Raise the minimum wage substantially. Build an economy that works for everybody. Put this country back together in a meaningful way. Get rid of the potholes, you know, that kind of stuff. If they can do that, then there's a very good chance that they'll be able to fight back the oligarchs. So to put this in a historical context, our first battle with oligarchy, of course, was the American Revolution. A monarchy is simply one form of oligarchy, only it's an oligarchy where instead of a group of wealthy people basically running the show, you have one family that is at least the figurehead for the oligarchs. And we fought a revolution against that in 1776. The second confrontation we had with oligarchy, or the first internal confrontation we had with oligarchy in the United States, happened as a result of a technological innovation. In 1798, a fellow by the name of Eli Whitney invented a machine called the cotton gin. Now, in the South, cotton was the principal product. Cotton actually produced more wealth for the United States from the early 1700s through the mid to late 1800s than anything else we did. It was such a major export, and so much of it flowed out of the Port of New York, and so much of the money went through the banks of New York, that when the Confederate States seceded from the Union and declared war on the northern part of America, on the Union, the mayor of New York City publicly suggested that New York City should join them. That's how, you know, there was a hell of a lot of money at stake here. So the bottleneck in making money on cotton, in producing large quantities of cotton, was cleaning the seeds out of the cotton. The bowls of cotton, little wads of cotton that grow is essentially the remnant of the flower of the cotton plant. Have embedded in them these fairly substantial seeds that the cotton fibers are glued to, essentially. And it's an enormously difficult job to pick those seeds out of that cotton. So what Eli Whitney invented was this machine that was like a drum with a screen all the way around it, and little hooks, long wires with a hook on the end, would go through those screens, grab a strand of cotton, pull it out, and the seeds couldn't get through the screen, and so they were stuck inside. And you crank this thing, and it would do this thing, and what was amazing was that this machine was able to do the work of 50 enslaved people, one machine. And so the larger plantations in the South who had the resources, Eli Whitney charged a lot of money for these machines, the larger plantations were able to buy cotton gins, and as a consequence of this, they could increase their cotton production 50-fold. And they wiped out their small competitors. And in the process of wiping out their small competitors, they bought up the land of all these small farms around them, turned in many cases the former owners of those small cotton farms into essentially sharecroppers, or employees living on what used to be their own land. And as economic power consolidated, the cotton gin, as I said, was invented just 2 years before 1800, but it really hit the marketplace in a big way around 1815. And so by 1830, this consolidation in the South was well underway. And in every single one of the cotton producing Southern states, which was the majority of them, what we saw was the large plantations getting bigger and bigger and bigger, these families getting richer and richer and richer, and all of them turning their eye to politics. They took over their state governments. They were already running a police state. In my first book on the hidden history of guns and the Second Amendment was written the way it was written to protect the slave patrols in Virginia and South Carolina, which and Georgia, which were the militias of the day. And so they already had a police state infrastructure, and the South had become a rigidified oligarchy. And they were very upset about the fact that there was still this democracy, a very loud, noisy democracy going on north of the Mason-Dixon line. And it was infecting people in the South. It was causing rebellions. It was causing discontent, across the board among enslaved people and among the poor white people who had been pushed off their farms or lost their farms and had become, the employees of this oligarchy. And so they essentially declared war on us, said, we don't want a democracy in North America. We're going to take you down. And they nearly succeeded. 600,000-700,000 people died. But we fought them back, we beat them back, and we defeated them. And we then broke up those giant plantations. One of the largest in Louisiana, Parchman, is now the Louisiana State Prison. One of the largest in Virginia was that of Robert E. Lee's. Robert E. Lee's plantation is now known as Arlington Memorial Cemetery. So we put the oligarchs basically back in a bottle. Then another technological innovation brought about our second confrontation with oligarchy in the United States, which reached ahead in 1933. But the second confrontation with oligarchy really began in the 1880s, 1890s with the railroad and steel and oil and coal just all of these industrial dynamite, chemicals, all these industrial processes that produced a new generation of oligarchs, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the Morgans the Astors, and on it went, and those oligarchs started getting very politically active, reaching out for control of not just individual states, but the nation as a whole. There was a blip in right after 1901 when McKinley was assassinated and his vice president, Teddy Roosevelt, became president. Roosevelt was a progressive and he tried to take on the oligarchs with the Tillman Act in 1907 that forbade corporate sponsorship of candidates for political office, and by breaking up the big monopolies, a job that was actually the breaking up of Standard Oil was completed by his successor, another progressive Republican, President Taft. But that kind of fell apart with World War I. And then in 1920, an explicit embrace of oligarchy was the campaign slogan of Warren Harding. Warren Harding campaigned on basically two things. His first slogan was called a return to normalcy. The top income tax rate at that point in time, the top bracket, was 91%. It was a remnant of World War I. And Harding said, we're going to drop that down to 25%, which he did when he was elected. His second campaign slogan was more business in government, less government in business. In other words, privatize, deregulate. And he did. And that kicked off the Roaring Twenties when the average working person's wages went down and the very rich got explosively rich, so much so that they created this teetering edifice of money that crashed in 1929, which opened the space for Franklin Roosevelt to come in the election of 1932 and directly take on the oligarchs. The oligarchs were not pleased with this. And in fact, a group of businessmen, it's called the Businessmen's Conspiracy, a group of wealthy oligarchs pulled together, put together a deal with a very, very right-wing, virtually Nazi veterans organization, veterans from World War I and the Spanish-American War. They had over 100,000 volunteers. They were gonna march on the White House and kidnap or kill Franklin Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, and put in and install as president a good Republican. The mistake they made was going to the most famous general in America at the time, Smedley Butler. He's a Marine general. He was the most decorated man in the history of modern history of the American military. He was the hero of World War I, a hero of the Spanish-American War. And he blew the whistle on and shut that thing down. which led to Franklin Roosevelt in his 1936 speech, his acceptance speech at Philadelphia in I believe it was August of 1936, saying, you know, these economic royalists need to be overthrown. He literally used the word overthrow. We need to overthrow this emerging monarchy, essentially. My word, not his. It's an absolutely brilliant speech. I encourage you to look up and read FDR's 1936 acceptance speech. It's mind-boggling because he calls these people out over and over and over again in that speech and declares war on them. And he did go to war with them. And he put them back into a bomb. And they stayed there until the 1980s, by and large. And what we saw out of that was the fastest growth of the middle class in the history of America. We had never seen a middle class grow nowhere in the world, actually in the history of the world. We'd never seen a middle class grow that rapidly. The modern oligarchy that we're fighting came out of that. And where it started, arguably, was in 1951. A fellow by the name of Russell Kirk wrote a book called The Conservative Mind. And this is the book that kicked off the modern conservative movement. And in the conservative mind, Kirk posited, he went back to the debate between Hobbes and Locke in the 1600s. Hobbes had published Leviathan in 1651, the book that famously said that, you know, man's original state, in man's original state, life would be nasty, brutish, and short. But Hobbes also posited that we could govern ourselves. Locke, the next generation, Hobbes was the tutor to King Charles I as a child. Locke was the tutor to King James I as a child. Locke, about 30 years later, in the 1670s, published the Second Treatise on Government, and he said, Hobbes is wrong. The essential nature of humans is not evil, it's good. And therefore, it's even easier for us to govern ourselves. We can even more easily govern ourselves. And that, and along with the writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was more of an anthropologist, he was looking at the reports that were coming in now to Europe from explorers who were visiting North Africa and West Africa and the East Coast of the North America and, you know, Central and Northern South America. And what they were finding were Aboriginal indigenous people who were actually living a pretty good life in many cases and didn't have warfare. I mean, Ben Franklin summed it up when he brought 34 members of the Iroquois Confederacy to the opening day of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787 and gave this speech where he said, it would be an extraordinary thing if five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a union that has been an indissolvable bond of peace for 1,000 years, and 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can't do the same. So Rousseau was writing about this, and this idea that people could govern themselves, that we didn't need a monarchy, we didn't need a lineage, we didn't need the oligarchs, really caught fire in the minds of the people who founded this republic. So anyhow, Russell Kirk goes back to the beginning and basically takes Hobbes's side of the argument, the conservative side of the argument, the people are evil. And Kirk predicts in 1951 that this growing middle class phenomena that America was then witnessing, and at that point in time, we were the fastest growing, largest middle class ever seen on earth. It was a brand new thing. He said, if this continues, if average people, being unreliable as they are, being greedy as they are, being pickpockets and thieves and shoplifters given a chance as they are, if average people continue to get wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, and keep in mind, in 1951, the top 5% were getting rich more slowly than the bottom 90%. The bottom 90% were growing both in wealth and in income faster than the top 5%. And it stayed that way right up until the end of the 1970s, the early 1980s. So anyhow, Kirk says, if that happens, it's going to be the end of American society. Now, he really believed this, and these conservatives really believed this. And so you could argue that this is, you know, the the tragedy of good intentions. You know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But Kirk said that basically, if the middle class got wealthy enough, what you would see is that young people would stop respecting their elders, that women would no longer know their place, that racial minorities would start demanding equality with white people, that and basically that all hell would break loose as a consequence of this, and that working people would no longer respect their bosses, their betters. And you know, when he published the book, it had a following among the intelligentsia. This was the book that really, you know, awakened Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley Jr. You know, I remember as a kid in the 1950s, late 1950s, early 1960s, sitting with my dad and watching William F. Buckley on TV, you know, talk about this stuff. But nobody really took it seriously in the United States. I mean, it was talked about academically until around 1963. In 1961, the birth control pill was legalized. By 1963, the birth control pill was in widespread use, and it kicked off the women's movement. Women could now control their reproduction, their, you know, their potential for reproduction, and started demanding an equal place in the marketplace, in the job market. By 1965, you had the beginnings of the psychedelic movement, and young people starting to, by 1966 and 67, certainly pushing back against the war in Vietnam, saying, hell no, I won't go. You had a civil rights movement led by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and others that was big and visible and scary to a lot of these white conservatives. And by 1967, 68, 69, you had cities that were on fire as a result of this. You had women, quote, burning bras. You had young people burning draft cards. You had union workers going on strike in record numbers. And at that point, the conservatives in the Republican Party and some of them in the Democratic Party looked back at Russell Kirk's writing and said, my God, he's right. We've got to strip back the wealth of this middle class, or this country is going to become a hellhole. And so the Chamber of Commerce, Eugene Sindor, the director of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, talked with his friend and neighbor, Lewis Powell, a tobacco lawyer in Virginia, and said, give us an outline. What should we do? How do we deal with this? We don't want our society to collapse. We're loyal Americans. We want to have a safe country. What do we do? And Lewis Powell outlined it. He said, okay, you know, we've got to seize control of all these systems that have kind of fallen apart. We've got to get our people in the universities so that we can start teaching young people a good conservative worldview in the political science and economics departments. We've got to take over the political space. We've got to pack the courts. We've got to control the textbooks in the schools. And he just went through this long list that we've got to have our friends buy up the media and consolidate the media. He laid out a blueprint for a conservative takeover of America in 1971. The next year, Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court, Lewis Powell. And over the next couple of years, some very, very wealthy people, in particular people who had been previously, like Fred Koch, had previously been funding the John Birch Society, started funding programs like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Every single state has a, you know, the state policy network, every single state has their own right-wing think tank in it that would turn out material for the newspapers, op-eds. You know, just Google any topic that's controversial right now, and the top 20 hits that you're going to get are going to be things that either came out of a right-wing think tank or were published in a newspaper or magazine by somebody who was a graduate of a right-wing think tank. I mean, they've had tremendous influence. And then Reagan came into power. And Reagan's number one mandate, there's one more piece to the story. In 1976, the Supreme Court, Lewis Powell now on the court, the Supreme Court changed the rules of the game. After the Nixon bribery scandals of 73, 74, we passed a lot of good government legislation limiting the influence of money in politics. It was done under Jerry Ford's administration by and large, but it was good stuff. And so in 76, Lewis Powell and the Supreme Court looked at these laws and they said, you know, if a individual billionaire wants to own a politician, wants to be the principal patron of a politician, the only source for that politician, and that politician wants to do whatever that billionaire wants in terms of producing legislation and voting, we used to call that corruption. We used to call that, in fact, bribery. But we're not going to call it that anymore, because what we're going to say is that money is not money. Giving money to a politician, that's not bribery. That's not money. That is speech. And so when a billionaire owns a politician, he's exercising his right of free speech, which is protected by the First Amendment. And then 2 years later, in another decision that Lewis Powell actually wrote, called First National Bank versus Bilotti, the Supreme Court extended that logic to corporations, because, you know, corporations are people too, you know. This opened a floodgate of cash. Now, the Democratic Party really didn't have much interest in all this corporate and billionaire cash that was flooding into the political system, because they were really well funded by the unions. Keep in mind, at that point in time, a third of Americans had a good union job and they were paying union dues. And so working people were funding the Democratic Party through their unions. The unions were so awash in cash that a few corrupt union leaders, Frank Fitzsimmons, Jimmy Hoffa, were able to skim money off the top. In fact, Jimmy Hoffa skimmed $1 million off the top and used it to bribe Richard Nixon. So the Democrats weren't interested, but the Republicans said, cross my palm with cash, I'll take whatever you've got. And that flood of cash brought Ronald Reagan into office. And Reagan's first job was to defund the Democratic Party, destroy the funding base for the Democratic Party, which meant destroy the unions. And he declared war on PATCO. In 1 week, he took down one of the only two unions that had actually endorsed him for president. They thought they had a deal with it. And in this, he was following the model of his role model, Margaret Thatcher, who 2 years earlier had done the exact same thing with the largest and most powerful union in the world, arguably, or certainly in the United Kingdom, which was the coal miners union. She destroyed them. It was a much longer process, but it worked. And Reagan was so successful in doing this. In the 12 years of the Reagan and Bush administration, they wiped out almost half of the unionization of America, that in 1992, Bill Clinton had to go hat in hand. He and Al Fromm created this thing called the DLC so that they could funnel corporate money into the Democratic Party. He had to go hat in hand to the bankers and the insurance companies. The deal that they came up with, that they thought what they would do is, we'll take money from the good corporations, tech, insurance, banking, you know, the good people. And we'll leave the dirty industries to the Republicans. Thank you.
Take a break for 20 minutes.